This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And Brett Blackledge, the editor of the Daily Advertiser, is slated to be our first guest. And Matt Doyle is producing. If you'd like to send us an email, please send it to talk@talklouisiana.org. Brett is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He won the Pulitzer Journalism's highest honor for his investigative series on Alabama's two-year college system in 2007. And he, of course, comes to Louisiana as a native of the state, graduate of the Manship School. And good morning to you, Brett Blackledge.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, nice to talk with you. And in Lafayette, one of the few places in America where there is kind of a newspaper war going on, what's happening in Acadiana?
Well, what's happening here is we're building a great team and really looking at an opportunity to tell the story not only of Acadiana but of Louisiana to the rest of the country. It's an exciting time.
Now, I know the Advocate hired some of your people away. Has that in any way affected what's going on at the Advertiser?
Well, it gave me an opportunity. While I'm from Louisiana, I worked here initially, even as a clerk at the Baton Rouge paper, copy boy, if you will. Graduated LSU, worked in New Orleans at the AP for a while and left, and went off and did journalism in other parts of the country. And this opportunity popped up, and it was a great chance for me to come back to my home state and do what I love, and that is to build local journalism and to promote the communities that we serve. So that's the biggest impact in a selfish way that I can describe, yeah.
You, Brett, as noted, spent a lot of time in Louisiana, graduate of LSU, and while you were at the old war school, some people who are in journalism now were affiliated with you. You had quite a crew at the Reveille back in the day.
Yeah, you're right. And it's fun. In this opportunity, I've been able to connect with some of those folks. And through the years, as journalism has changed and as things have contracted across the country, some of those folks have moved on into other jobs. A friend of mine is now a lobbyist. Another friend is an OBGYN. Another one has gone into law practice. So it is interesting to see over time how that happens. But it's also great to be able to catch up with people. So,
I know some of your contemporaries at LSU were Dane Strother and Stephanie Regal and J.R. Ball, so an illustrious group. Now, one of your mentors was John McGinnis, and come Saturday, it'll be 5 years since this fine man and exceptional journalist died, and he was one of a kind.
You know, John was an amazing journalist at a time when those of us who were pursuing daily, traditional, what you might call legacy journalism, John was really shaping the way to do extraordinary investigative work in a weekly publication, Grigri, at the time when I knew him. And he gave me my first cover story and, frankly, my first decent check in journalism. But he also gave me a lot of inspiration and taught me to not follow the rest of the pack. He built a career on paving his own way, doing his own thing, and doing it successfully. And I always thought that was so brave, and I've tried to do that in my own career because I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I miss him, and I wish I could catch up with him now that I'm back, but I'll finally remember him.
What was the first story?
The first story that he had me do was get into the politics and money of some of the oil lobbyists, and I had a chance in doing that to work with him, and he edited me well, gave me great sources, taught me how to dig deeply into the subject, and it was a great opportunity. I also had a chance in that story to attempt to get an interview with Edwin Edwards. It didn't go as well as I'd like, but it was fun to do it anyway.
What compelled you to come back to Louisiana?
As I mentioned, I think the opportunity in Lafayette is extraordinary. I mean, this is an incredible community, number one, that is so tied to its history with its newspaper of more than 153 years. And I have a chance that you don't have often. We're building a brand new team, hiring people from all over the country. Some people we're getting from Louisiana, and extraordinary talent. And who has that chance in their career to be able to build from the ground up such a great newsroom? And in a community that has long supported its paper and expects great things from its paper. And candidly, I've been told we haven't delivered in past years, and so we've got our work cut out for us. But that's something that is an extraordinary challenge, and it's a lot of fun. And I think that is something we have an opportunity here in Lafayette to really help reshape what we do in local journalism in Louisiana, and that's a great opportunity. And secondly, the other thing that I believe in, we don't have to limit our audience to the people just in Acadiana. There are tremendous stories to tell the nation about this region. One thing I realized after I got back and talking to people around here, very little is known about this part of the country, and that's not a good thing. I mean, we've got to change that. We've got extraordinary stories to tell about our culture, about our business, about the things we do as people, about our history. And those are the kinds of stories that, first of all, we want to celebrate locally because we have lots to be proud of. But second of all, we need to let the nation know that. And we got to let them know what opportunities are here and what can be done in a big way here in Acadiana and what is being done that you probably don't know about. So that's exciting.
877-217-5757 is your number for Brett Blackledge. You'll be with us a bit longer. The Daily Advertiser editor, 153-year-old newspaper. And I would think that based on what's happened, that you're probably getting some calls from some Times-Picayune employees.
I have, yeah. It's heartbreaking what happened in New Orleans. And it may be the singular biggest disaster in American journalism this year. I mean, it's an extraordinary tragedy, and it breaks my heart as a Louisianan, as someone who believes in local journalism. But the good thing is, if there is a good thing to say about it, I have met dozens of Times-Picayune reporters. I've had them here. I have more coming in. There's extraordinary talent there, and I am doing everything I can with all of my colleagues across the country to help them. I want them here in Lafayette. I want them in other places, other papers we have here in Louisiana. But I want to help them in any way I can. And what is inspiring to me is the top leadership of my company, my top bosses. We all got on a call on the day this was announced, and we committed ourselves to helping them in any way we could because it's such a tragedy to see what happened. And they've done some amazing journalism. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to watch, visiting with them as I did, back-to-back interviews Monday through Friday of last week and many of them this week, any chance I can to bring them in and talk to them or to talk on the phone, to see the work they've been doing, to see the inspiration that they give the rest of us. We should do everything we can to help them, and it's just an extraordinary thing. What I'm sad that I can't do, because I just don't have the ability. You know, there's 65 journalists who will be unemployed for the most part now. There's another 100 or so people who actually helped put the Picayune out, and they're going to be without work.
All right, well, we'll hold that thought. This has been portrayed nationally and locally as a kind of a David takes down Goliath episode, and it is good that New Orleans will have a daily newspaper now, but you're viewing it as a tragedy? Is that hyperbole, or do you really see it that way?
Oh, my God. Take a step back. Let's think about it. I mean, forget the narrative you just described, because that's a fake narrative. Is there any other way to describe when 160-plus people lose their jobs? Is there any other way to describe when 65 local journalists will no longer be employed in Louisiana? I mean, that is gutting the largest. This is a city that is in the top 50 metropolitan areas of our country. It just lost its newspaper that was older than 180 years. That's heartbreaking. And no one should try to portray that as a positive thing. There is nothing good that comes out of that. That's a horrible tragedy. And all the parties involved in that transaction are responsible for that. It's devastating.
All right, hold that thought. Brett Blackledge is fired up. He certainly has a long history in journalism and in the newspaper business, and he views what's happened in New Orleans with the Advocate takeover of the Picayune as a tragedy because many people will be losing their jobs. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we'll return after this 90-second pause with more Talk Louisiana. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. We're with Brett Blackledge, a Pulitzer Prize winner, Louisiana native, and since April 1st, editor of the Daily Advertiser in Lafayette. He was born in Baton Rouge, the son of a legal secretary from Avoyelles Parish and a Department of Transportation employee from Baton Rouge, who served in state government for 3 decades, and his parents met at LSU, married in Lafayette, and that's where Brett Blackledge is with us right now. And as we hit the break, Brett was lamenting the takeover of the Picayune by the Advocate because even though we'll have a 7-day-a-week printed newspaper in New Orleans, many journalists will be losing their jobs, 65 of them, Brett says. But Brett, a listener, Howland Monroe, says Gannett has also cut a lot of people, your employer. So is that just the nature of the beast now?
Yeah, no, look, no one can deny, look across the landscape, across the country, at the what's happening in local journalism all over this nation. And that is, frankly, why I left national reporting to go back to local journalism, because I believed in the ideal that communities deserve newspapers. And so the disruption of my industry, and it's severe, it's significant, all over. Every company and every private investor that owns newspaper properties is working with less today than they did 5 and 10 years ago. And it is sad to see it. But here's my commitment, and the reason why so many of my colleagues across the country still do this work. We have to redo this concept of local journalism. We have to do it better. We have to be more responsive. We came out of an era 30 years ago of arrogance. You know, we didn't care as much as we should have about what readers needed and wanted. That's got to change. You know, we can't think of the daily paper in the way that I started back in the 80s. The idea of we'll tell you what you need to know whether you want to know it or not. That's no longer the way to do this business. And yes, there have been layoffs, and that's tragic, and it's hard, and it makes serving our communities harder. But as long as we are committed to doing it and figuring out how do we recreate this in a way that's responsive to our community, where people truly want to read us, we have to reinvent that, and we're doing it. And there are great pockets of success. I've been a part of some of that. I want to bring that here to Lafayette, and I want to do what I can to help that in Louisiana journalism. Because, look, several weeks ago, the Bastrop paper closed. That was heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And this is something we all need to pay attention to if we truly care about local journalism. Closing a newspaper is not progress in the movement to improve local journalism. Let's be clear about that.
Well, and closing it in the largest city in Louisiana, one of the great treasures in America, it is a loss, but on the whole, New Orleans still has a newspaper, and that is a plus. And John Georges, he has done something that is amazing. I don't think there's any question about that, whether you like what he's done or not. He has pulled off an amazing ability to make a couple of huge transactions, getting the Advocate and the Picayune. Who would have thought that would have happened a few years ago?
Well, yes, I want to be clear, because I have friends and people that I greatly respect who work at the Baton Rouge paper. It is a great paper. Remember, that's my hometown paper. And I remember the days when it wasn't a good paper. And I remember how it was a paper that underachieved. And the way that Baton Rouge paper has been transformed is remarkable. It is a great newspaper, and the Pulitzer this year is no accident. It is a product of the great journalism. What I have a problem with, the idea of buying any community newspaper and killing it is not the way that it's done, and this is unusual in the way that it's being treated. So, for example, a wealthy owner of a newspaper, and you're seeing this across the country, it's not an unusual model, but there's dangers in it too if we're not careful. What is their commitment to local journalism? And that is something, as we move into the era of greater numbers of papers that are taking over by wealthy barons, we have to ask ourselves, are they truly committed to the community they serve? Or will they, 5 years from now, after they buy a paper and maybe they gobble up a couple of others, will they decide, you know, I'm no longer interested in the journalism business. I think I'm going to pull out. And they pull out, and then what's left in that community where there's a bureau set up to create a New Orleans version of a Baton Rouge paper? What's left there? Does that shut down? And then what does New Orleans have? To me, all that's right, the thing I fear.
You're describing the new configuration as a New Orleans version of a Baton Rouge newspaper?
That's essentially what it is. That's what it is. Think of it this way. New Orleans, a month ago, had a newspaper. And we can look, I grew up in the company that owned that paper, and I'm not telling you I agree with what it did to that paper in 2012. But you know what? That's their decision. That's fine. But the truth of the matter is, a month ago, that paper, in the infrequent days it was printed in that community. And there were people who sold advertisement in that community.
All right, hold tight. We've got a few folks who want to talk to Brett Blackledge, editor of the Lafayette Advertiser, Barry in Mid-City. Hi, Barry. You're on the air with Brett Blackledge.
Thank you so much. Another great program. I'd like to ask your guest about the Facebook news thing, and I really don't go there at all, but it seems like so many people are now getting their news from that Facebook news thing. I don't know.
All right. What about Facebook as a viable news source?
Well, you raise a really good question. I mean, it's a really good point, and it's something that I think all of us are reflecting on, particularly after we've seen how news on Facebook can be manipulated by outside parties. And it is something that I think we all have to be mindful of. From a local perspective, when we share our content on Facebook, because there are so many people who, you know, frankly, are on Facebook, right? That's where some of that audience is. We try to do so in a way that it's very clear that it's coming from us.
All right. Dominic in Bro Bridge. Dominic, you're on the air. Oh, I lost Dominic. Let's go to Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Brett Blackledge. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Good morning. I've seen the trend where people are being asked to do the jobs of another person. So, there are shifts like guys go to work in our business in the film world, and they work 12 to 16 hours a day.
All right. With fewer people, is there more of a burden to do more from each employee?
You know, I think that sometimes happens, and here's the other thing I think that we are trying to do as we rethink that concept. There's a better way to do what we do, and in other words, do we have to continue doing the things we did 10 years ago that maybe weren't serving our readers? Should we drop some of that and move to things that readers care more about?
Dominic in Brobridge. Hi, Dominic. I think we got you this time. You're on the air with Brett Blackledge.
Yeah, all righty. Yeah, I'm just flabbergasted by your guest comments about the Advocate doing what it did in New Orleans. It is, there's still a paper there, like you said, Jim. It publishes 7 days a week. It will take some of those reporters. And Gannett, of all people, has done more to destroy this business by cutting back, dumping on the staff to be videographers, writers, photographers, all at once.
All right. Your thoughts about Dominic's laments?
Well, I mean, look, I don't want to disrespect Dominic's point, because here's the truth. I didn't grow up in the company that he referred to. It's known as Gannett. Most of your listeners probably don't know what that is, but it's a large newspaper company, owns 109 newspapers. And I think what I have seen in my time with Gannett as this company has restructured itself, I have met and talked to a lot of people who have been disgusted in the past with the way the old company did business. And look, I can't judge that. I respect if they have that opinion. That's not what I'm doing now. It's not what the people that I respect across the country are doing.
Let's do it again very soon, Brett Blackledge. You're a very good guest, full of passion about what you do and the newspaper business. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Brett. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Let's talk soon.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is our producer, and your number is 877-217-5757. We talked to another journalist based at the Capitol, as we do on most Thursdays, Mark Ballard, the bureau chief for The Advocate, the newspaper of record in Louisiana. And we're in the home stretch of the legislative session. And this year, like so many others, these very personal social issues have taken hold. And this is almost reminiscent of 1990, when Buddy Romer vetoed two anti-abortion bills. Governor John Bel Edwards will likely get a fetal heartbeat bill banning abortion after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. And the governor on his radio show yesterday, Mark, said he is inclined to sign that legislation. It is something that many thought a Democratic governor would not do, but he's not just any kind of Democrat, is he?
No, he's a Southern Democrat, so that was unexpected, or not unexpected. That was totally expected that he would sign that, or say that he would support that bill. He holds out the possibility, if the wording isn't to his satisfaction, that he won't sign it. But I think pretty much he's going to sign that bill, and it will pass overwhelmingly in the House.
And Louisiana is such a conservative stronghold that the main sponsors are fellow Democrats, John Milkovich in the Senate, Katrina Jackson in the House. Louisiana, being a Democrat in Louisiana is much different than being a Democrat in California or New York.
And that's something I'm pretty sure that the governor is going to be underlining over and over again in his campaign come this fall.
Well, speaking of the campaign, yesterday the governor, when he was on the air for his monthly Ask the Governor program, discussed the president of the United States trying to get Steve Scalise in the race as late as last week. Here's how the governor responded.
You've gotten along very well with the president, but there were reports last week that on Air Force One, coming to Louisiana, he was trying to get Steve Scalise in the governor's race.
Yeah, well, I've read about that, I guess, the same as you did.
What did you think?
Well, you know, I thought it was pretty interesting. It's I guess, more than anything else, that here we are almost June of election year with an election date looming on October the 12th, and is still fishing around for candidates. So that was not an unwelcome, deal. But, you know, Steve is actually a friend of mine. We've gotten along well over the years that we've served together in the legislature, or with him being in Congress. I think he really likes Congress. I think that has more to do with it than anything else. But you know, we'll just see what happens. And as you indicated, we've had a pretty strong working relationship, not just with the president, but with his cabinet, with the administration as a whole. And we're going to keep doing that, because it's the best way to serve the state of Louisiana.
Is it fair to say he wanted to support you as a Republican?
I think that would be fair, but I don't really want to discuss too much of that.
Okay. All right. It's fairly apparent that the president made an overture to John Bel Edwards to switch parties, and he declined. And some would say, why wouldn't he? He's very conservative on social issues, but something deep within him
causes him to remain a Democrat, Mark Ballard. And sometimes it's good to dance with the people who brought you, and the Democratic Party certainly brought him to the election of 2015 as their candidate, and he got 40% in the primary, 56% in the runoff, and now he is a governor of Louisiana and also the only Southern Democratic governor in the country, Deep South right. governor.
Well, I would argue that, at least in the early days of it, that he was the one that brought the Democratic Party.
That's right. It's true. As of August of 2015, they were still trying to get him out of the race. They were shopping for other candidates. But being a Democrat and having the field cleared enabled him to get 40% with a shoestring budget. This time, and a listener points this out, and I think she may be right, the governor may be spoiling for a challenge from the left with this abortion stand. Somebody may get in the race and run to the left of him, which would almost certainly assure a runoff, which, of course, he would like to not have. But he's positioned now for a challenge from the left. I think that's fair to say.
It is, but I mean, first off, I think being a Democrat allows him a lot more flexibility on those issues that the Republicans are very stringent on and tend to vote against their own people when they stray off of those party lines. But I think there could be someone from the left that jumps in. But really, Steve Scalise, maybe Kennedy or Cassidy, are the only ones that could actually jump in at this late date and have enough money and name power to give him a good challenge.
Elizabeth Crisp, who used to cover the state capitol with you, is now in Washington, and she has a story in today's Advocate. Kennedy pushes House on Trump. Urinate or get off the pot, says John Neely Kennedy. Now, most men probably don't sit down when they do that sort of thing, but maybe John Kennedy does. But at any rate, he is avidly defending the President of the United States. No surprise there either.
None at all. From everything I've been reading in the national media, is that that seems to be the theme now. Is the Democrats are just spoiling for a fight that they've already lost.
Now, the story about Wendy Vitter has been permeating the last few days. She was approved as a federal judge on a 52-45 vote. It would have been 52-48, but Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Kirsten Gillibrand, they were unavailable to vote because they're campaigning for president. Party line vote. But now there is a report that Mitch McConnell brought this to the Senate, perhaps in an expedited fashion, because David Vitter, as a lobbyist, got his Russian oligarch connection to open a plant, $200 million facility in the great state of Kentucky. Do you think this story has legs, or does it go away pretty quickly?
Yeah, I don't really know about that particular story. I think that they brought it forth because there had been a lot of criticism about Wendy Vitter for her stances on abortion, for working with the church in New Orleans, and just basically her very uber conservative stances. I think that was. And they needed, it was going to be a 52 vote, and they needed to get it done before those critics were able to peel off a couple of Republicans.
As we head down the stretch, Mark Ballard, it looks like sports betting may hit the finish line successfully. Teacher pay, but a lot of other measures like equal pay and minimum wage, they went by the wayside, and as you say, no surprise.
No surprise there. I think that the drama we're going to be seeing on sports betting, I'm not sure that it's done deal yet. Today there's going to be the monetary regulatory section of that bill. I mean, basically what the taxes are going to be, how it's going to be regulated. It's on the House floor. It needs 70 votes. If it doesn't get through and sports betting is legalized, then the sports betting won't take place until they can get some sort of regulatory framework into position. And also that in the House there was instead of just taking it up on the House floor. They shunted it off to the Appropriations Committee to take a look at what the costs are going to be. Many people are looking at that as a way to kind of run out the clock on sports betting.
You have a front page story. Our guest, Mark Ballard, does. Voting along racial lines, a Louisiana House committee approved legislation to set up a transition should St. George elect to become its own city. What's going on here?
Well, this was a transition that was the bill was put in to create a transition. You know, how are we going to deal with the sales taxes that are collected in there during this time between incorporation and the vote? And it was brought up now before the vote because the vote's going to be in October. There won't be another session until after the vote, and so they didn't want to sit on it that long. What really created a problem was a last-minute amendment that was added onto this bill after all the sides had agreed on how the transition would go. And in it included wording that said basically that the residents of St. George, should they vote to be a their own municipality, would not have to be paying for bonds and pension plans and other expenses that were brought in as a parish-wide type of an expense, which would have included them. And the mayor is very upset about the fact that this was kind of a naked effort to try to get them out of paying their fair share of the parish expenses that were made on their behalf and the rest of us in East Baton Rouge Parish.
And it was Bodie White who sponsored that measure that got original support, and of course Bodie White was the opponent of Sharon Weston Broome.
And he says it's not a personal. he said it was that the agreement that they came up with was a little too fuzzy, and it needed to have some specifics so that when the both sides sit down to negotiate how this is all going to take place, that they needed to have a specific framework. That was why he did that.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, the governor said he hoped John Ilario would run for election as a House member again. But at this point, it's uncertain if this man who first took office May 9th, 1972, as a state lawmaker will make another go at it.
The rumors are around is that that he may be retiring on May 31st, or you know, announcing it on May 31st when he gives his farewell speech. But, you know, rumors abound here at the state capitol. He has been... he's had his hands elbow deep in state government since the 70s, you know, since you and I were children, and has basically been the steady hand on the tiller for all that time.
Mark Ballard, it is always good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care.
All right.
We'll be back next week with Mark Ballard and next segment with Ani DeFranco here on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and we're joined by one of the most remarkable performers in our world, Ani DeFranco, with a touching and raw memoir. The singer-songwriter and social activist who changed the music industry has published her book, No Walls and the Recurring Dream. And good morning to you, Ani.
Good morning, Jim.
I think it's
nice
fair
to be here.
Well, it's great to hear your distinctive voice, and I think it's fair to say you've had a full life.
Yeah, yeah. There's only half of it there in the book. That's all I could fit.
Well, and you probably have half of it to go. So,
I'm hoping.
But the first half has been quite a foundation and a lot of ups and downs, and you go through just about all of them, and it's been quite a voyage for you, and you've taken chances, some chances that might have affected your career. How have you persevered?
Well, yeah. I guess every choice had an effect, and you know, there's upsides and downsides to any path chosen. I chose to remain independent, sort of outside of the music industry, and had this sort of daily problem-solving task of how do you do that and have a career in music, and so that's led me down. Some blind alleys, but some wonderful landscapes, into some great landscapes. You know, there are, of course, things you lose when you don't partner with big record companies and such, but in this landscape that I have moved through, I've found so many teachers, so many wonderful experiences. So, yeah, I just tried to put a few down in the book.
This isn't bad for a woman who was sleeping in a Buffalo bus station when you were 18 years old, I think. So you have come a long way.
Yeah, I was 15 in the bus station.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's been a long adventure. That early emancipation was sort of a necessity. My family was a kind of a exploding family, and so I was on my own. But it's been a great ride. You know, I think part of the memoir process for me was realizing how great a ride it's been. I think in my sort of my distilled memories, which I had to push past to really write this book and get back to those former selves, my distilled memories were darker and more negative, and the process of the memoir made me feel more grateful.
Last night you were in New Orleans at Garden District Books, and this is a city that has become your city. You really have a passion for New Orleans.
Oh, I sure do. Yeah, I mean, any musician will understand, and most humans, about the magic here. And for me, it's, you know, I started hanging around New Orleans in between tours 2 decades ago, and then I started renting an apartment, and then I was just the guest that never left. You know, there's just such a cultural ferment down here.
How was it forming your own label, Righteous Babe Records?
Well, I mean, you know, humble beginnings. You know, at first it was more sort of a statement, almost. It was something that I chicken scratched onto my first cassette and then CD, and it was a statement to myself as much as anyone, you know, that I don't need a record company to have a job as a musician, as a songwriter, as a folk singer. And then it slowly became a reality, this idea of Righteous Babe Records, in that I hired my best friend, my boyfriend at the time. Then I hired my other best friend, and then, you know, we went from there kind of constructing a record company with very little experience, knowledge about such things.
I think you were 19 at the time, weren't you?
Yeah, 19 when it was originally called Righteous Records. When I, you know, whatever, went down to City Hall and filled out a DBA, and I was Righteous Records. Then a few years down the line, we discovered there was a Righteous Records in Oklahoma that released gospel music. So I had to change my name.
To Righteous
Babe. And it was Righteous Babe, you know. It was a gift that gospel label gave me, because I think Righteous Babe communicates more clearly, you know, the who and the what.
You've sold almost 6 million albums since then, so Ani DeFranco has done very well. But along the way, you've become a social activist as well. Was that by design?
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, yeah. My parents gifted me with an awareness and a level of responsibility, you know, or maybe accountability is a good word, accountability to my society, you know, starting with the act of voting, you know. Also, my mother, you know, she would help local candidates in Buffalo that she believed in. I went door to door with her, you know, campaigning back in, you know, that's how you did it in the 70s. And, you know, licking stamps and sending out mailings and trying to support people doing good work of positive change, you know. So I learned from both my parents how to be a citizen, and I've tried to be responsible to that ever since.
We're visiting with Ani DeFranco. Her book is No Walls and the Recurring Dream. What a wonderful cover shot there is. You've got some real definition in those biceps, by the way.
Well, yeah, that was me at 21 or something. I was pretty stacked by the time I was 28 and had been playing every night and ripping at that guitar.
Well, you have worked on reproductive rights, and right now that's a big issue in Louisiana and beyond, and I suspect you're disappointed with the way lawmakers are veering these days.
Oh, it's terrifying. It's just really deeply terrifying and so sad, you know, to know how many women will be hurt, how many women will have their personal missions in this world thwarted by enforced reproduction. I believe reproductive freedom is a fundamental civil right. I think that that's the appropriate way to address it politically. You know, I mean, pardon the pun, but trumping even the, you know, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, you know, these are essential things to being free within society, but freedom of when to reproduce is just seismic for women. And without that choice, it is, women are not free within society. And I think that reproductive freedom, I sort of see it not even as just preserving the rights, the civil rights of women, but providing a path towards healing all of the social diseases of society. I think women, once they are free, will have agency. They will be able to come and find a place at the table. And once the masculine and the feminine are in resonant balance at all the tables, when we're designing, you know, our political systems, mm-hmm. our societies, our cultures, this is what's going to create the balance from which we can heal all of our social diseases.
You've made many memorable performances, but one at Carnegie Hall 2 weeks after 9/11 is seared in the memory bank for those who were there. How was that experience?
Yeah, it was a few months after 9/11, but I started there in the book in that moment on that stage just because it was a good representation of this reoccurring moment in my life where I'm on stage and I'm going out on a limb and the limb is shaky. And, you know, like in that scene that I recount in the book, I can hear people begin to sob, you know, in the balconies. And here I am addressing 9/11 with the people who shouldered the brunt of the loss and the pain and thinking, oh, no, have I overstepped? And that is a constant question in art, at least in my journey in art, is where is the balance point, you know, between painful truths and painful silences?
Where does your passion for poetry, for songwriting, for dancing, where does it come from?
Well, I think initially it comes from a troubled childhood. I came from a troubled family. In a troubled city, Buffalo, New York, economically depressed. I needed to let that out of my body. And I searched high and low for any kind of way, painting, dancing, singing, playing. You know, I needed to let the pain out of my body. It always hurts my heart to hear in economic downturns that, you know, they cut arts funding for children first, you know, as though that's the least essential. And I almost feel the opposite, that children, when they are surrounded by strife and are, yeah, they need an outlet.
Well, the book is No Walls and the Recurring Dream from the remarkable Ani DiFranco. And we congratulate you on your work and commend you for your passion and for your social activism. You're certainly in the arena in a huge way. And Ani DiFranco, we're also pleased you spend much of your time in New Orleans.
Oh, well, thanks, Jim. It was nice to talk to you.
It's a pleasure, and hopefully we'll do so again. Once again, the book is No Walls and the Recurring Dream, quite a memoir from Ani DiFranco. And we'll close the show today with some of her remarkable music.
Give me that look that's like laughing with liquid in your mouth, like you're choosing between choking and spitting it all out, like you're trying to fight gravity on a planet that is...